Whoa, a showdown between the federal government and the state of North Carolina as to who gets to go into bathrooms and locker rooms. Wow.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Did you ever see one of those old westerns? And there's going to be this duel. There's going to be this face-to-face, who's going to blink first kind of confrontation, who's going to back down first. Boy, that's how it feels right now in the state of North Carolina, as it is North Carolina versus the federal government. The federal government has no business getting into our bathrooms and locker rooms. The federal government has no business doing what it's doing. And concerned citizens around America, because this does not just affect North Carolina, this affects all of America. Concerned citizens across America need to send a message to the government, need to stand with Governor McCrory in North Carolina and tell the federal government time to back down. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. What do you think about what is going on? You might say, I don't really know what's going on. I don't live in North Carolina. I haven't followed this. Well, let me clue you in. We've been told that there have been no instances of any kind of problems with transgender bathroom access, locker room access, etc. There have been no problems with this whatsoever for years and years and years. And yet, despite allegedly no problems of any kind, and despite this not being an apparent loophole for heterosexual predators to use for their own mischievous and evil intents, instead, the Charlotte City Council passed a radical bill that would have effectively rendered all restrooms and locker rooms in all public facilities in the city of Charlotte gender neutral. Yes, that's what the outcome, the effect, the impact would have been. A radical, crazy bill. Now here's the point. If there were no problems, why pass this? Why fix something that isn't broken? Why make something so outlandish now that, of course, the government is going to have to push back? And, of course, the overwhelming majority of the populace wants to push back and is not happy with this overwhelming populace of North Carolina. So the state legislature overturns that, says that Charlotte went beyond its state constitutional rights. And, of course, it's an egregious bill. It's an assault on the expectation of privacy. It does open up the door for heterosexual predators. It is definitely problematic. No two ways about it. No two ways about it. So there has been massive pushback against North Carolina. You say, yeah, but it also has discrimination issues with gays and lesbians. Hey, we were not having a problem in the state of North Carolina, according to everything that I know and have read over these issues. I'm not aware of one case making it to the Attorney General of North Carolina where someone was could legitimately claim discrimination based exclusively on their sexual orientation. In other words, here's a hardworking computer programmer, school custodian, school teacher, whatever, and it's found out that privately this person identifies as gay or lesbian, and they were therefore fired over that. Nothing to do with their job, nothing to do with something they were trying to push in the workplace. I'm not aware of that happening or any cases making it to the Attorney General. In any case, the issue that everyone's focused on is bathroom privacy and locker room privacy. And right now, the fact of the matter is that North Carolina has pushed back and said to the federal government, as the federal government told them, they gave them 3 working days. The federal government said, you get rid of this bill or you potentially lose $4.5 billion of school funding. How outlandish. North Carolina had a reply today. They said, we're filing a lawsuit against the federal government. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
North Carolina is facing a deadline today over the state's controversial transgender bathroom law. The federal government last week warned North Carolina that this newly passed law violates civil rights protections. The law requires transgender people to use public restrooms that match their biological gender. The Justice Department gave Governor Pat McCrory and other lawmakers until the end of the day to declare the state won't enforce the law, or they may face a possible lawsuit.
Yeah, you talk about bullying. The Department of Justice writing to North Carolina, giving them an ultimatum that gave them three business days to respond to a complex charge. And bottom line, the federal government wants to have its way in our bathrooms and locker rooms. The federal government wants to punish North Carolina, not just North Carolina, but any other state that would say, if you're a biological male, that you use the men's locker room and that you cannot share the girls' locker room in high school because you identify as a girl, and you can't use the girls' locker room and change room at the YMCA because you identify as a girl when you are a biological male. And if you were naked, it would be clear that you're a biological male. And the women can see that you're a biological male. You don't belong in the women's locker room. There's the expectation of privacy, at the very least. There's the fact that this opens the door for heterosexual predators who have been documented to use these types of access laws. And why open the door wider to a sexual predator, talking about heterosexual predator, and why further traumatize a woman who's been abused or raped? Why is there no consideration for everybody else? 866-348-7884. So what's happened is the federal government has given an order to North Carolina. They had until today, three working days from when they got this, to say either you're going to comply or not. We want a yes or a no. Gun to your head. We want a yes or we want a no. That's it. And it's unreal. So Pat McCrory was on with Chris Wallace, Fox News, yesterday, and actually flew in to be on the broadcast, which was a good move. I was taken aback by Wallace's attitude. Now, I haven't watched him a lot. I normally read transcripts and things like that. I haven't watched him a lot. I was disturbed with his approach. Someone who's watched him a lot said he was actually fairly mild. But let's listen to some of the interaction. And Joey, grab clip number 5. And Pat McCrory is on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace discussing what the Department of Justice is trying to do, what they're trying to push on North Carolina.
The bathroom laws that say it only applies to government buildings, our schools and our universities and highway rest stops. It doesn't apply to anyone in the private sector. In fact, our ruling says that the government shouldn't make bathroom laws for anyone in the private sector.
Understood.
That's up to the private sector. What I've asked for, I asked for Friday, was an extension. They gave the ninth largest state in the United States, the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, 3 working days to respond to a pretty complex letter and to a pretty big threat. Well, we don't think 3 working days is enough to respond to such a threat from a...
Did they respond to your request for an extension?
Yes. They said no, unless we will give you a 1-week extension if the governor admits publicly that the ruling, that their language regarding bathrooms does, in fact, discriminate. Well, I'm not going to publicly announce that something discriminates, which is agreeing with their letter, because we're really talking about a letter in which they're trying to define gender identity. And there is no clear identification or a definition of gender identity. It's the federal government being a bully. It's making law. It's in by their interpretation.
Exactly. Well said. Well said, Governor McCrory. Absolutely true, absolutely accurate. It is the federal government acting like a bully. It is the federal government saying you comply with our radical agenda or else. It is the federal government putting an interpretation on something that's not there. And the discussion continues. Go to clip number 7. Again, a question is raised. Well, tell you what, let's go to number 6. Pat McCrory wants everyone to understand that this is not just something that affects North Carolina. This affects potentially every state in America, colleges, universities throughout America as well. Listen to this further dialogue.
One thing the nation has to realize, this is no longer just a North Carolina issue. This order, this letter by the Justice Department is saying that every company in the United States of America that has over 15 employees are going to have to abide by the federal government's regulation on bathrooms. So now the federal government is going to tell almost every private sector company in the United States who can and who cannot come into their bathrooms, their restrooms, their shower facilities for their employees. And they're also telling every university in the United States of America. This is not just North Carolina. They are now telling every university that accepts federal funding that boys who may think they're a girl can go into a girl's locker room or restroom or shower facility.
Look, there is a lawsuit that has been filed by the Alliance Defending Freedom against the Department of Education regarding a school in the Chicago area where I think it's 63 girls and 51 families. It's on behalf of that many in one school district. 51 families, 63 girls who have had all kinds of issues because of the presence of a biological male in their bathrooms and changing rooms. It is absolute insanity. Look, we've been warning about this for years, friends. You think this is my favorite subject to talk about? You think this is my favorite subject to write about? We have been moved to, we have been prompted to because of the insanity of the culture. We have told you for years now that there is an all-out war on gender distinctions. Please understand the bigger issue here. It's not trying to find a compassionate solution to someone who is genuinely tormented over gender identity issues. Think of it as if it was your own kid or your own spouse or your own brother or sister or parent. You have compassion on those who struggle, but you don't turn the world upside down because of them, and you don't threaten everyone that will not agree with your radical agenda. So Chris Wallace pushes this issue. Well, what if this was a matter of the government stepping in on an issue of race? So clip number 7, again, this is from yesterday's broadcast on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. Governor McCrory, governor of North Carolina, flew in so he could sit down with him face to face.
Governor, you call this a case of Washington overreach, and I want to explore that with
yes.
you. Would it be overreach for the Justice Department to send you a letter like this to say you cannot have bathrooms in the state capitol, one for white and one for black?
Right. So fair question to ask. And here is the response from Governor McCrory, clip number 8.
I don't think there's any correlation between the two, and I think
but
it's
would
misleading.
You agree that that is within the federal government's purview?
Absolutely, but we can definitely define the race of people. It's very hard to define transgender
But the point is, the reason I ask is that the Justice Department says that just like whites and blacks, that transgender people are a protected class.
Right. And that's
that has a legal meaning, a protected class under the 1964 Civil Rights
Law. That's what they say, but that's not what the federal law says. The federal law uses the term sex. And Congress does not define sex as including gender identity or other terms that the Justice Department is currently used. So right now, the Justice Department is making law for the federal government as opposed to enforcing
law. It sounds like basically you're going to challenge this in court.
We're looking at all our options right now.
There is no comparison between saying black men have to use a separate bathroom from white men because they are both men, okay? And transgender identity can be fluid. You can be gender fluid. You can have multiple identities. Remember Facebook. Come on, friends. Remember this. Facebook, under transgender activist pressure, came up with 50 different ways to identify your gender. And when that was not considered enough, they came up with fill in the blank. Friends, this is some of the gender insanity we are dealing with in the culture. And now the federal government, complete overreach. It is complete and absolute overreach. And there is not a specific category of transgender that is definable as race is definable or ethnicity is definable. It is really extraordinary that we have to have this discussion. I can only tell you, friends, I hate to say, I told you so. We'll be back with your feedback. 866-34-TRUTH. I'll take some calls when we come back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The state of North Carolina now firing back, filing a lawsuit against the federal government over that so-called bathroom bill. This comes hours before the deadline imposed in a letter sent to state leaders by the Department of Justice.
Exactly right. Did the one thing that was right and that it needed to do. North Carolina has said to the federal government, stay out of our bathrooms and stay out of our locker rooms. We didn't have a problem. City of Charlotte tried to fix something that wasn't broken. North Carolina State put things back to where they should have been. Common sense, privacy. Oh, boy. And now having to take on the federal government. Friends, I wish folks had listened, more folks had listened when I and others had been warning that this stuff was coming for years now. 866-34-TRUTH. Here's a statement from the North Carolina Values Coalition regarding the announcement made by Governor McCrory concerning the lawsuit against U.S. Department of Justice regarding the Bathroom Privacy and Security Act. Quote, it's not the role of the federal government to mandate radical and extreme bathroom policies to a state like North Carolina, forcing our citizens into giving men access to the bathroom, showers, and locker rooms of women and young girls. Governor McCrory has taken the common sense approach by filing a suit that asks a federal judge to determine whether the Obama administration can unilaterally change the meaning of the term sex in our country's anti-discrimination laws to include transgender. Where did that come from? Who gave the government the right to just change the meaning of sex? Based on your, you can't discriminate, say, based on race, based on sex. Well, sex now includes gender identity. Said who? 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Philip, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
First of all, I'm with you on the federal government violating North Carolina states' rights. In trying to overturn and actually strong-arm North Carolina through HB 2. I agree. But unless I'm wrong, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I could be, but it seems like when it came to the Defense of Marriage Act, you were on the federal government side and not states' rights side.
It had nothing to do with states versus government. It had to do with the issue, to be perfectly honest with you. And in other words, I've been issue-driven. If, for example, you talk to Senator Cruz about these kinds of things, he said, according to the Constitution, it's all state rights. I have other friends that say, no, there's certain things that are just wrong. In other words, the states are not going to vote about, say, can two brothers marry or a brother and sister who are 18, can they marry? We're not going to say just leave that to the states. So to me, what the government did, it's all about doing the right thing. Okay, if the government is seeking to do the right thing, I stand with the government. If the government is seeking to do the wrong thing, I stand against the government. So to be perfectly candid, Philip, I didn't think it through in terms of state rights versus government. I thought it through in terms of the issue itself. That's a whole other discussion about what states' rights and what's federal government.
I understand that. It just seemed like you were arguing it from the position that it was just federal government overreach to come in and tell North Carolina what to do, but it was fine if it was in something in your favor, Defense of Marriage Act, for example. At that point, you defend the federal government. It just seems like me.
Yeah.
To be consistent and I understand if you want to argue it from a scriptural right or wrong basis, but it seemed like to me you were positioning the argument based on the federal government had no right to come in and do that.
Well, number one, they don't have a right to. In other words, the Defense of Marriage Act could be defended that they did have a right to do that, whereas this, they don't, because there's nothing. Philip, just listen. There's nothing that the government is basing it on. It's a misreading of Title IX. Okay, it is complete government overreach. There is nothing that gives the government the right to redefine the meaning of sex so as to include gender identity. And there is nothing in Title IX, which is what they're using to justify this. So that's why it's overreach. There are certain things I'm fine with the federal government doing. This is wrong. So there are two issues, state rights and federal rights. And then when is there overreach? Look, if the state of North Carolina overreached, I would jump on the state for overreaching. The overreach is the issue. It's nothing to do with what's in my favor now. It's a matter of what's right, what's in harmony with our Constitution, what's in harmony with our history, what's in harmony with what's best for society, etc. So I'm being quite consistent in that regard, to be honest, sir.
It doesn't seem that way, but it's your show, so argue the way you like.
Hey, it's your right to call in and differ with me, so thank you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Bart in Des Moines, Iowa. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure thing.
First time I've ever called in, so pardon if my voice is a little nervous. But
it's just two of us having a chat. You can be relaxed.
Okay. Yeah, sure enough. I'm just listening to your opening today. I've been listening to you a long time. But the difference that I'm seeing here is people are trying to redefine sexuality. The reason we look at race as being your ethnicity, it's something that's incredibly sacred. It's who God made you to be. And also with your sex, the sex of who you are, whether male or female, it's who God made you to be. And by them trying to muddy the waters and create this lucid, flowing capability of not defining someone by their race and or by their sex, it changes the rules completely. And you have to have rules in reality so that it'll congruent with life.
Exactly.
Your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Once it becomes a matter of perception, then everything changes. And all that we know, there are cases of biological and chromosomal abnormalities, Bart, and we want to be sympathetic to that, that some people, the tiniest percentage, don't neatly fit into male or female categories. For the most part, 99% of the time, that's not the issue here. We're dealing with purely perception. So if I perceive myself to be black and believe I'm black, and now I want to be part of an affirmative action program for minorities, I mean, that's crazy. You can't do that. The exact same thing here. So you're exactly right in your comments, Bart. Much appreciated. Hey, friends, can I change yours totally? Because this is pretty heavy stuff. And just speak to you about grace for a minute. My new book, The Grace Controversy, is out. We've got a whole grace resource package with The Grace Controversy, Hyper Grace, and a CD called God's True Grace. So let me just leave you with these words in this segment now from my CD on God's True Grace.
God's grace is more amazing than we could ever understand. Let's not diminish it by thinking we have to work for our salvation or work hard so one day God might like us. No. And let's not diminish it by thinking grace means anything goes. It's a pure and holy and beautiful stream God's called us to swim in. It's one where the pollution stays out so we can become more and more like Jesus. Let's spend the rest of our lives exploring the beauty and power and riches of God's grace. And hey, that'll get us ready for eternity when we'll do it forever and ever and ever.
My friends, no matter what's happening around you, keep your focus on the Lord. Check out our special resource package on grace at Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. I'm sure you'll be richly blessed.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us today on the broadcast. Yes, we are your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity in the midst of a society in chaos and a church all too often in compromise. I've used that phrase for years now on the air. And maybe when some of you first started listening to me, maybe you started listening 3-4 years ago, maybe 6-7 years ago, and you'd hear me say that. What do I mean by a society in chaos? What do I mean by a church all too often in compromise? Now it's becoming clearer and clearer by the day, if it hasn't become already. No, you're not losing your mind. The world is going crazy around you. 866-34-TRUTH. So yesterday is Mother's Day. And of course, President Obama puts forward a very politicized Mother's Day announcement. Rather than simply honoring mothers, incredible job mothers do, the sacrificial job that mothers do, rather than doing that, President Obama politicized Mother's Day. And this is what he said. He issued a proclamation celebrating, quote, those who are the first to welcome us into the world, rightly so. And he had a lot of great things to say through his proclamation. But he said this: performing the most important work there is, mothers, biological, foster, or adoptive, are our first role models and earliest motivators. They balance enormous responsibilities and shape who we become as adults, their lessons guiding us throughout life, regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, or marital status. Mothers have always moved our nation forward and remain steadfast in their pursuit of a better and brighter future for their children. So notice those phrases. Why does he have to say that? Why does the president of the United States, not the fragmented states, but the United States, although we're quite fragmented right now, why can't he bring a unifying statement? Why does he have to bring a divisive, controversial statement on Mother's Day? Quote, regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, or marital status, mothers have always moved our nation forward. This echoed his 2015 proclamation in which he said, quote, whether married or single, LGBT or straight, biological, adoptive, or foster, mothers are the bedrocks of our lives and the foundation of our society. That's what he said last year. Married or single, LGBT or straight, so he wanted to make even clearer this time, gender identity, and added in marital status. So, Mr. President, why politicize Mother's Day? Oh, I may get a message out, someone else may get a message out, who's not the president of the United States, but as the president, you want to be a unifier, not a divider. So, what about, look, there are single mothers who are courageous, who have done, I don't know how they've managed to do what they've done. They've been breadwinners. They've been mom and dad to the kids as best as possible. They've functioned often under tremendous pressure. And many have done an amazing, amazing job. And so many have tried their best even when they fell short. But what about someone that chooses to have a kid out of wedlock because they want to have a baby, but they don't want a husband or father involved? They want to have a baby. Love child, whatever you call it. They want to have a baby. That may not be the best definition here. But they don't want to be married. And is that the best role model for a kid? That's a question I ask in my article. You can read it on stream.org. President Obama politicizes Mother's Day. Is that the best role model? And is that in the best interest of the kid to say, I choose to bring you into this world but deprive you of a father and deprive you of watching how a mom and dad operate? Lesbian moms, I'm sure there are lesbian moms who are as devoted to their kids as any mothers in the world and who would die for their kids. I don't doubt that. And I'm sure there are many who are extraordinary moms. I just ask the question, is it the best case scenario? No, they didn't choose their sexual orientation, make a conscious choice. You know, I think I'm going to choose to be lesbian and choose to be attracted to women. And we don't assume that. We assume the opposite. But they did choose to be raising kids without a dad. Is that the best role model for the kids? And is it best to willingly deprive a kid of a mom or a dad? Just questions to ask in light of the president's statement. We'll be right back. Hey, this is Michael Brown. I want to invite you to join me for our second ever trip to Israel, February 25th through March 6th, 2017. This is a great opportunity. I get to interact with you, our radio listening audience, and our ministry partners as we experience the land of Israel together, and it will be a life changer. We've got a great price on the trip, and if you're one of our monthly supporters or torchbearers, you're eligible to receive a special discount for this once-in-a-lifetime experience. Space is limited, and we're accepting applications on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information on the trip to secure your spot, go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the Israel banner, or call our office at 704-782-3760.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I hope you can join us in Israel next year for the trip of a lifetime. Go to the website, AskDrBrown.org, find out more. Get your deposit in as soon as possible. That's at AskDrBrown.org. Bring a group from your church, bring your family if you can. It's going to be an extraordinary time together. 866-34-TRUTH. We continue to talk about the war on gender distinctions. We continue to talk about the war on privacy. Extraordinary. So Chad Griffin, who heads up the Human Rights Campaign, gay activist, was asked at a press conference on Thursday in Raleigh by CBN News, so Christian News Broadcasting. They asked him about why conservative Christians should oppose HB2. He said, to be honest, I'm not aware of those who support the bill. Huh? How about the strong majority of the state supports the bill? How about hundreds of Christian leaders who've spoken out supporting the bill? Griffin said, while many Christians oppose the bill, quote, the most Christian value says, love thy neighbor, thou shalt not judge, we are all God's children. Well, Chad, the most Christian value says, because you love your neighbor, you tell them about Jesus. The most Christian value says, because you love your neighbor, you tell them who God is and how to please God and how to receive forgiveness of sins. And Chad, what about all of the women and children that are not happy with this bill? Don't we love them? If my neighbor, let's just say, all right, if my neighbor is a heterosexual predator, do I love him by letting him into the house with my daughters? Is that how I love him? Or do I love him by saying, sir, you need to turn yourself into the authorities if he's broken the law? Or, sir, you need to get professional help? Or we can help you in our church. Chad Griffin also warned, quote, the purveyors of hate may attempt to abuse and use religion to justify discrimination, but they ultimately can't get away with it. Chad, drop the rhetoric, please, sir. Drop this purveyors of hate stuff. How about the flood of hate that comes from your side towards ours day and night? How about the flood of misinformation that comes our way from your side day and night? How about the bullying? How about the mocking of those things that are sacred? How about the tearing up and rewriting of scripture, as if you could do that, to support your viewpoint? And on it goes. Sir, great advice. Step back, look in the mirror, and allow God to help you in your own life. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Barbara in Staunton, Massachusetts. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Michael Brown. Basically, I just wanted to say thank you so much for voicing everything that I pretty much feel in my heart as the mother of two children. One will be 5 this summer, the other 9 years old. Before I ever became aware of this bathroom bill controversy, I never let my children go into the bathroom alone because I would hear nightmares, all these stories about children going into McDonald's and getting raped. And, you know, before you become a mother, there are certain things that you don't even think about. For example, I never thought of not letting a little boy going inside of a McDonald's bathroom because of things that have occurred in the past. And I'm sure our lawmakers are well aware of these things, but yet they continuously put our children's lives in danger, which is only making my life so much more difficult as a parent. Now, who's going to protect me? Okay, I need to be in there to protect my children, but now I don't think I'll ever be able to go into a public restroom again if this keeps on continuing.
Yeah, Barbara, you know something extraordinary, that we got a call from social worker in the Boston area. I should say someone who worked at a women's shelter, and she told us that a man can walk in there and by government regulation, a man can walk in there and say, I am a woman. I identify as a woman. He can be dressed as a man totally, and yet they have to give him a bed for the night or for however long. They have to let him use the women's bathrooms and shower stalls. And the other women have complained and are upset, but they've been told there's nothing they can do. So,
see, that's why I don't understand, because this is still America. What happened to freedom of speech and everyone has a voice?
Well, not just freedom of speech and everyone has a voice. What happened to sanity, right? I mean, we're...
Exactly. Exactly.
And look, you want to help everybody. But as I've said many a time, if you have one student in the school that's blind, you don't make everyone close their eyes and read in Braille. You try to accommodate that one student. If you have a student, a little kid that's genuinely confused, maybe one out of 1,000, that's genuinely confused about their gender identity, and they get very upset when they're treated differently, okay, they have a deep problem, a deep issue, we want to try to help them, but you don't now impose that on everybody else. You don't say that Johnny, who everyone knew as Johnny, is now coming back as Jane, and 7-year-old Johnny Jane uses the girl's bathroom, and then say a 14-year-old was Johnny last year, now is coming back as 15-year-old Jane, and is now going to play on the girls' softball team, and is going to shower with the... It's social madness.
And if the rest of the country wants to participate in this...
Hey, somehow we just lost you there, Barbara. Not sure what happened, but listen, by God's grace, we're going to continue to articulate these things. We're going to continue to be a voice. We're going to continue to stand and speak. Yes, let us reach out with compassion to those who are struggling, but let us not turn the world upside down on behalf of them. 866-34-TRUTH. Hey, you may have missed this. Maybe you were getting a Mother's Day card. You may have missed this, but grab clip number 3, Joey, and let's listen to it first, and then I will comment afterwards. This is from Hallmark.
My mom is probably the most light, bright, positive person I've ever met in my life, and that's just how she's always been. I've never felt home in my body. And even though I was born a girl, I've always felt like I was a boy. And I was afraid to tell her because I thought love would have conditions. And the unconditional love that she's shown has made me a better person in all of my relationships.
Hey, I appreciate this individual, identifies as transgender, right? Although I was born a girl, I always felt like I was a boy. But when she tells her mom and says that she felt like a boy, the mom affirms her as a boy, and she's been, this woman is so grateful for that. And National Center for Transgender Equality, the executive director, Mara Kiesling, said, as someone with a mother as bright and wonderful as Alex's, I can attest to how basic a parent's unconditional love is. On this Mother's Day, we should celebrate parents like Pam and my own mother, Elaine, who show unconditional love of their kids. Hey, I am all for showing unconditional love. I am all for loving that kid through the struggles. But unconditional love often does the hard things. Unconditional love often says, hey, your kid, we love you, we care about you, but we want to assure you that there's a better way. We want to assure you that God didn't make a mistake and put a boy in a girl's body or a girl in a boy's body. And the even stats would tell you that the vast majority of kids who identify as transgender before puberty do not after puberty. So why now contribute to something that's going to make wholeness more difficult later on. And look, if the best cure we had for cancer right now, you have cancer, you know, in a certain part of your body, is amputate, okay? Amputate. We're gonna cut off the, okay, you got cancer in developing a leg. Okay, we cut the leg, we cut both legs off. That's the best solution. You say we keep looking. Look, with breast cancer, mastectomies, radical mastectomies, they're often what's called for, but we keep looking for a cure because we know that's not the best. Why is it when it comes to transgender issues, do we just accept the best is hormones for life and sex change surgery? Why don't we say there's got to be a better way? Let's keep looking for it. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, let's. I'm getting a swirl of emails coming in and notes, and so much going on with North Carolina taking on the federal government. But remember, as Governor McCrory said, this is not just affecting North Carolina. This potentially affects every state in the union. 866-34-TRUTH. So here's an interesting question, all right? And this is Ed Whelan on nationalreview.com, Bench Memos. He's got an interesting note here. And Ed Whelan, let me just get his exact info. He has an extensive background when it comes to legal issues. He's the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And he directs EPPC's program on the Constitution, the courts, and the culture. I believe we've had him on the air. 2011 National Law Journal named Mr. Whelan among its champions and visionaries in the practice of law in D.C. So he addresses a common issue about women who really do look like men. So one, he says, right in the National Review today, one common policy objection I hear to North Carolina's HB2 law on access to single-sex, multi-occupancy bathrooms and showers in public schools and government buildings goes something like this. Quote, there are transgender men, that is biological women who identify as men, who look just like men. You really want to force them to use the women's restrooms? Won't that scare the women and girls you say you want to protect? The objection is typically accompanied by a photo of someone who has identified as or is implied to be a biological female, but who, through the uses or abuses of modern chemistry and surgery, does indeed, at least when partly clothed, look just like a man, facial hair and sculpted chest muscles included. The objection is a worthwhile one to consider, but it turns out that serious consideration of it defeats and highlights the folly of the transgender claim led by the Obama administration for a one-size-fits-all requirement that anyone who identifies as a member of the opposite sex, no matter his or her appearance, be allowed to use the single-sex facilities of the opposite sex, no matter whether those facilities are restrooms or showers or dormitory rooms, no matter whether they're in schools or businesses or public places. He said, I'm setting aside in this post that the Obama administration's claims about what Title VII and Title IX supposedly require are legally meritless and incoherent. He's completely right. And I'm instead focusing just on the question of what sound policy ought to be. So consider, he says, one, people who identify as transgender do not define themselves by their outward appearance. Don't take my weird word for it. Here's GLAAD's emphasis at it, GLAAD Gay Activist Organization. Quote, gender identity is a person's internal, personal sense of being a man or a woman or someone outside of that gender binary. For transgender people, the sex they were assigned at birth and their own internal gender identity do not match. Most transgender people seek to bring their bodies more into alignment with their gender identity. Many transgender people are prescribed hormones by the doctors to change their bodies, some undergo surgeries as well, but not all transgender people can or will take those steps, and it's important to know that being transgender is not dependent upon medical procedures. So Ed Whelan says, thus, there are men and boys who identify as female, but who don't look at all like women or girls, whether that's because they're in the early transition process or because they choose not to, or because whatever the steps they've undertaken haven't changed much. Vice versa, of course, for women and girls who identify as male. Two, so the very same situation that the transgender advocates try to deploy to their advantage, an unknown person who looks like a man enters a women's restroom, is exactly what their own position would call for. The only difference is that in their example, the person who looks like a man is a biological female, whereas in my example, the person who looks like a man is a man who thinks he's female. So transgender advocates can't coherently object to laws like HB2 on this basis when their own preferred solution would yield the same result. Number three, there are, of course, plenty of other scenarios that women and girls would likely find even more jarring than the intrusion in a restroom of someone who looks like a man. For example, having men or boys take showers with them and watch them dress and undress. Come on, friends, do we have to talk about this? Is it beyond belief that the federal government is arguing for something like this and threatening North Carolina and potentially other states with loss of federal funding for education? Because the state says we don't want biological males showering next to biological females? Wow. Wow. Somehow the transgender folks seem not to factor these scenarios into their calculus. Why? Because they don't want to. And after all, why should they have a problem? They should have a problem. The women should have a problem with that. Four. More broadly, it is highly doubtful that there is a single one-size-fits-all solution to the various scenarios that arise. If that is exactly what the transgender advocates in the Obama administration are trying to impose. It is they who have made it impossible to retain any informal system of customized accommodations that reflect particular circumstances. And it is exactly such a system that would have allowed women who really look like men to use the men's restrooms. Five, his closing point. In the face of the transgender assault, HB2 is an entirely sensible, though necessarily imperfect, response. Far from trying to impose a uniform solution, much less force women who think they're meant to use the women's restrooms, it leaves private businesses entirely free to adopt whatever policies they want for their restrooms. It also allows public schools and government buildings to provide single occupancy facilities that can be used by anyone. And under North Carolina law, anyone who undergoes a surgical so-called sex change can change the sex listed on their birth certificate and thus use the facilities of his gender identity. Extraordinary that we even have to have this discussion. But friends, we told you it was coming. We told you there was an all-out war on gender. So U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch will hold her news conference at 3:30 today to announce a law enforcement action against North Carolina that stems from the state's anti-LGBT bathroom bill, HB2. Wow. Can everybody just step back together and say, wow? First, they come up with a complete misreading of Title IX and Title VII. I've looked at Title IX more carefully, but a complete misreading of both. Second, they're now going to change the law based on their interpretation, so they're making law. Third, they're going to give North Carolina, and they did, three business days to respond. And then when North Carolina follows a countersuit, now they're going to crack down even more. Across the nation, I know I can't assume that I've got governors across the nation listening to me right now, but I've got people across the nation listening. Contact your leadership in your state. Urge them to stand together with North Carolina. Urge them to make it known. Let governors across the nation make a statement. Let legislators, congressmen, congresswomen across the nation make a statement. Representatives, make a statement. We are standing with North Carolina. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. We are out of time in this hour. I've got some very special guests coming on for some important interviews in the next hour for those that will be listening then. I may be able to get to some calls as well. Visit the website. You want to check out my latest articles, my latest videos. They are all relevant to the cutting edge issues of the things that are happening today. So by all means, visit the website, askdrbrown.org. Check out our very special resource package, three great grace resources that will really impact your life for many years to come. I truly believe that. My bottom line today, let the church be a voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity as the world goes crazy around us.
Change the world.
We've got some special guests with some special interviews that you do not want to miss.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to The Line of Fire. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. Friends, it is very easy to look at what's happening in the world around you and pull your hair out. If you're completely bald, you want to pull your hair out. It's very easy to look at how long we've had Roe v. Wade in place and all the efforts to overturn it, and here we still are 55 million babies later. It's maddening to watch the federal government attack the state of North Carolina and try to force it on the state with a potential loss of $4.5 billion of funding to tell North Carolina, you must allow biological males into ladies' locker rooms and shower stalls and universities and high schools and public buildings, bathrooms and things like that. It is utterly maddening to watch this happen, which is why we must keep our focus on Jesus. We must see the insanity happening around us and then stand up together and say, we're going to do what's right. We're going to live this out. Here, 2 Corinthians, the fourth chapter, tells us that the whole world has been blinded by the deceiver. 1 John 5:19 says the whole world is under the power of the evil one. This we know. Scripture tells us plainly. We know there's mass deception. So even if we were not facing this insane war on gender, even if we were not facing some of the social madness of the hour, the fact of the matter is, it's still a mad world. It's still a fallen world. And what we need to do is see what's happening around us. That drives us. That drives us to prayer. That drives us to action. That drives us to take a stand. But then we've got to focus on the Lord and get our strength, get our insight, get our wisdom from above. So I want to encourage you today. I'm going to be speaking with a guest momentarily about the issue of abortion. I want to bring you some encouragement. I want to bring you some challenge and help today. But it is so, so important. It is so, so important that we not lose hope, that we not get away from the place of prayer, that we not get away from intimacy with God, that we not get away from meditation in the Word, that we not get away from sharing the gospel with others, and that we not get away from standing for what's right, standing for life, standing for family. Listen, every person that hears the message, every mother that has her child, every child that is adopted rather than aborted, every individual that receives the gospel and turns from death to life, even if you see defeat all around you, every victory is a victory that's precious and wonderful. Folks have often asked me, how is it that I stay encouraged? I don't try to. I don't make a conscious effort to stay encouraged. It's part of my relationship with God, but when I'm with Him, I have great hope. When I'm with Him, the God of the universe, when I realize that He rules and reigns, as much pain and conflict and sorrow as there is in the world, I have great hope. I have great confidence. I have great expectation. And not only so, when I know there's going to be opposition, when I know in advance things may get worse before they get better, and I see them get worse, it only intensifies my sense of calling and burden to swim against the tide and go against the grain and stand for what's right. So we come back. I want to speak with Amy Lynn Nelson about the very sensitive subject of abortion and hear what she has to say on a firsthand basis. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
For many years now, students in our ministry school and folks in our church, our congregation, have been involved in the pro-life movement. We have had friends for decades now on the front lines of the pro-life movement and have been involved wherever we can. And because there's so much going on in the society and the culture all around us, because the presidential nomination is, the presidential elections are obviously going to address this, the Republican Party platform being a strong pro-life platform, presumptive nominee Donald Trump not being as strong on these issues as we'd like him to be, the Democrats being radically pro-abortion in so much of their rhetoric and what they say, we're not just talking about issues here. We're talking about people. We're talking about human beings. We're talking about moms and the babies in their womb. So we want to address this in the most constructive possible way that we can. 866-34-TRUTH, the number to call. I'm speaking with Amy Lynn Nelson. Amy has served as a crisis pregnancy counselor and director for Save a Life, an abortion recovery ministry. She's been part of abortion recovery for 20 years. She's also served as an abstinence educator in public and private schools, sharing safe messages of sex and family education. Her passion is to help people see the emotional and spiritual costs of abortion and poor choices about sexuality. The website, amybehindthemask.com, the name of the book, Behind the Mask. Amy, thanks so much for joining us on the broadcast.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. I'm so glad to be here.
What's your own story? How do you get so passionate about this?
Well, because when I finished going through an abortion recovery group for myself to heal from a past abortion, I realized that when I went to Planned Parenthood to seek out an abortion when I was 18 years old, I was lied to. They told me that what was inside me was just a mass of tissue and that it didn't actually become a baby until later on in the pregnancy and that everything would be fine tomorrow. Well, you know, I went ahead and had the abortion. I didn't actually have it at Planned Parenthood. I was too far along at the time, and they referred me to a hospital. But I did go through with the abortion, and after I went through the abortion recovery group, they during the group, they showed us a embryonic development chart of the child in the womb, and I saw what my child looked like at 16 weeks and 5 days along in my pregnancy. And my child had a head, it had arms, legs, fingers, toes, and a heartbeat. And at first I was devastated because I had, you know, I know the type of abortion that I had. They went in there and ripped that my child apart piece by piece.
Mm.
And then I got angry because I was lied to.
Now, let me ask this, Amy. Mm-hmm. When you say that you were just told it's a massive tissue, who was this that told you that?
One of the counselors at Planned Parenthood.
All right, and did you ask questions or was this just part of their standard presentation?
Well, it's part of their standard presentation, and they focus on getting teenagers in there who are naive, ignorant. In my case, I was very ignorant. I was very sheltered and protected by my family, and I didn't even know what abortion was until someone said, you need to have an abortion. And and still, you know, I didn't even know what it was. And then, you know, they tell you, and they count on that. That's what they count on, because it's all a money-making business, and they want teenagers to come in there. They want college-age students to come in there who think that having an abortion will be better for their future, for them to go ahead and finish college and not have to fool with raising a child at that time. Mm. And they bank on that.
And how old were you at that time?
I was 18.
18 years old. Uh-huh. You mentioned an abortion recovery group. We don't hear much about this. You hear women talking about shout your abortion, things like that, right? Mm-hmm. But abortion recovery groups, that would echo what many women say to me when they call in when we talk about abortion. It can be 20 years ago, and they still grieve over it.
Absolutely.
They still have pain, and yet we don't hear about this. This is wonderful. We celebrate it. This is the best thing we could have done. So how common is it that women feel traumatized after having an abortion?
A lot of women. Well, the ones that I've had the opportunity to work with, I would say 85 to 90% regret it, and they do have the post-abortion stress syndrome. And they suffer. Like one of the very first post-abortion classes that I did, or abortion recovery classes that I did years ago, I had a lady come in who, she was an older lady, and she said, "Amy, I had an abortion during World War II in Germany," and she said, "I still hurt."
All right, so you speak of behind the mask. Is this what you're talking about?
Yes, because basically what happens is when you have an event like that in your life, and for me anyway, I wanted to show the world that, you know, I was still a good girl. But inside, I was in turmoil. I had a lot of shame, a lot of guilt. And so I wanted to put that behind the mask because I didn't want to tell anybody that I had had an abortion, because there's a huge stigma that comes with having an abortion. And so I wanted everybody to see the good girl person. So that's the way I went through my life, and I had a hard time. I mean, I really never let anybody into my life. I kept everybody at arm's length and very superficial. That's just the way I lived my life. And then finally, God started dealing with me and bringing me into the sexual abstinence presentations that I had the opportunity to get involved with, because I'm all about prevention. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, because, you know, we've had a lot of education about, you know, what abortion is through the years since Roe versus Wade back in 1973, but we don't have a lot of education as to what happens after someone has an abortion.
Yep.
And that's the very reason I wrote this book, because I want this book to get into the hands of our teenagers, of our college-age students, so they will know the aftermath of abortion. Just last night, I was talking with a young lady who is a sophomore in college, and I said, tell me what you know about abortion. Tell me about abortion there where you are in college. And she said, I know girls who have had an abortion because they wanted to finish college. She said they knew they were Christians, they knew it wasn't right, but they felt like that was going to be their best choice. I said, do you think that they thought about the long-term consequences of their actions? She said, no, I know they didn't.
Yeah, so let's talk about Planned Parenthood then. Mm-hmm. Will Planned Parenthood tell young women? And by the way, I'm looking at stats. Goes back a few years to 2007. Uh-huh. There was a major study done in Ontario, and they found that 60% of teen pregnancies in Ontario ended in abortion.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about a large, large number of young women,
yeah,
of teenagers, that are being impacted by this, putting aside the tragedy of the lost life in the womb.
Right.
But why is it that Planned Parenthood doesn't warrant? I mean, there's a self-evident answer, but let's talk about it. Why don't they tell the person? Look, I was talking to a doctor once about a kidney stone issue and potential surgery. This, well, they tell you the problems.
Right.
If you have this, these are the consequences. Or if you take this medication, here are the side effects. This is pretty major. Mm-hmm. But they don't tell you that you may suffer this, and there are recovery groups. They don't tell you any of that?
Oh, no. Well, they don't care. You know, it's all about money. It's all about making a buck, and they want you in there, they want you out, and, you know, that's it. And, like, when I had my abortion, they were at the hospital. They actually were using an ultrasound machine, and there were two doctors looking at the monitor, and I asked them to see what they were looking at, and they turned the monitor further from my view so there's no way I could look at it. And I wonder, well, I feel sure that day, if I had had the opportunity to see my child in my womb, I would not have gone through with the abortion.
Yeah, and the fact is, what is it, 75-80% of women that do see,
mm-hmm,
the baby in the womb,
yeah,
choose not to have the abortion. So you have to dehumanize the baby.
Right.
And I've pointed out that I've never heard a woman who was pregnant say, and she miscarried, I lost the fetus. I've never
right.
once heard that. I've always heard I've lost the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize how traumatic miscarriage was for so many women until a friend of ours miscarried and it was years and unable to have a baby. I mean, this thing hung over for years, and that wasn't any choice she made, but that was the pain of the loss, the reality of that baby in the womb. All right, Amy, when we come back, I want you to explain how it is that in the midst of this darkness that you have hope. And then I want you to tell our listeners what this book, Behind the Mask, will do and who especially you recommend it to. Amy Lynn, Behind the Mask. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
These are staggering stats. I hate to say stats because each one of them involves at least two lives directly, the life of the mother, the life of the baby in the womb. 18%, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which is, of course, pro-abortion, 18% of U.S. women obtaining abortions are teenagers, 15 to 17, 6% of all abortions, 18 to 19-year-olds, 11% of all abortions. And if you add in 20, 21-year-olds, it's got to be a very, very high number added in as well. Black non-Hispanic women, according to boundforlife.com, have the highest abortion ratio. Black women's abortion ratio has reached 444 abortions per 1,000 live births. This is tragic. Well, non-Hispanic white women's abortion ratio is 124 abortions per 1,000 live births. And to me, this is an attack, a real satanic attack on African-Americans, on Hispanic-Americans. I'm not here pointing fingers. I'm saying this is an attack. We need to help. Amy Lynn Nelson has written a book, Behind the Mask. And Amy, is the book under Amy Lynn Nelson or Amy Lynn?
Amy Lynn.
Okay, so L-Y-N-N-E.
Right.
Before you tell me how it is that you came through all this, your own recovery from abortion, mm-hmm. your own frontline work with a sense of hope and optimism, tell me why you wrote this book and who in particular will benefit by it.
Well, I wrote the book I'm all about preventive measures. And so I wrote the book to minister to teens and young college-age students who are contemplating having an abortion. I want them to understand the aftermath associated with abortion, because I think that our kids and our young adults, they are all into education, and they want to know, and they want to know truth. And so I wrote this book so they would know truth, so they would be able to make educated decisions for themselves.
And in particular, is there an age group, or is it women of all ages that could have abortions? Is there a target audience?
Well, anybody, any woman who has had an abortion would benefit from reading this, because basically what I've done is I'm very transparent in the book. I laid out the process of what led up to having an abortion, and then went through the process of going through the abortion recovery group. And during that time, you know, I had put God in a box, and before I went through the abortion recovery group, and I just felt like there was nothing else he could do in my life. I was just, you know, going to be miserable. I was going to be depressed. I was going to be, you know, just living with all this guilt and shame and bitterness. And, you know, through the years, it had just turned into bitterness and anger. And I just felt like that's the way my life was going to be. And, you know, I never would have attributed my current day emotional state with all the negative junk going on to an abortion I had when I was 18 years old.
All right. So at what point did you go to the abortion recovery group?
I was 31 years old.
All right. So there've got to be a whole lot of women in your state. So let's say a woman who knows nothing about postpartum blues, and, you know, after having a baby, the hormone changes, maybe she's depressed, and she can't understand why she has a baby. And then someone says, oh, this happens to lots of us. Right. Okay, you put that together. But if not, you think, what's the matter with me? Am I losing my mind? Am I not fit to be a mother? Right. So, and then someone comes back from war in Afghanistan and they don't know about post-traumatic stress syndrome. Mm-hmm. And they think I'm losing my mind and they turn to alcohol and get suicidal. And then someone says, no, no, this is a known condition. But how in the world is someone going to think 13 years after an abortion that the struggles I'm having today go back to that? So there must be millions of women exactly. in this condition with no clue about it.
Exactly. Exactly. And that is also one of the reasons why I wrote my book, so they could see, you know. And I did not know that that was one of my issues because I had been doing the sexual abstinence presentations in the public school systems. And one of the things that we do is we have a little construction paper heart, and, you know, we can't really talk about God in schools, but, you know, we can say, you know, when the guy and the girl come together, there's, you know, there's a bond that takes place. You know, we know it as the two shall become one flesh. But, you know, we explain to them that when they have sex with that person and that relationship breaks up, that part of their heart is torn off and forever a part of that other person. And so we go through several examples, and you're sitting there with a fragmented heart. And, you know, I would hold out that heart and ask the kids, is this the kind of heart you want to give to your mate when you get married? And they're like, no. Well, one day I was in the class, and I held out that heart, and I looked at that heart, and God said, that is your heart. I'm like, wow. And so I began to pray and ask God to heal my heart. And 2 weeks later, I'm sitting in a stoplight after I dropped off my daughter at school, and now I do have a child now after I had the abortion, but I was sitting at that stoplight, and all of a sudden God brought back to my remembrance lying there on that table and feeling them pulling that baby out of me that day at the hospital, and I lost it. I went to the lady who was the coordinator of our abstinence program, and she just held me in her arms while I cried over the loss of my baby.
Mm.
And she said, Amy, we want you to go to the abortion recovery group that we have. I'm like, what is an abortion recovery group? And a lot of people don't know that abortion recovery groups are offered. And so I would like to take a moment to say, if you have had an abortion in your past and you suffer from depression, a lot of anger and bitterness, please call a local crisis pregnancy center and ask them to point you in the direction of an abortion recovery group. Everything they do is very confidential, and you will not believe the change in your life. And usually it's like a 10-week program, and it will be the best thing you've ever done.
Wonderful. And thank you for being so open. Again, the book, Behind the Masks, the author, Amy Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E. We've just got a minute, but you have hope. You're not depressed. You're not discouraged.
No.
Why
no.
is that?
Because God completely and totally healed my heart. You'll have to read the book since we only have a minute left, but you can find it at any online bookstore. It's Behind the Mask by Amy Lynn. You can go to my website at amybehindthemask.com, but God brought forth a peace from the time I became a Christian until we had a memorial service to give honor, dignity, and respect to the children lost through abortion. And to that night, the devil taunted me with the thoughts of killing my child on a daily basis. And after that memorial service, the next day I woke up and I had a peace in my heart that I still have to this very day. And I would like to encourage everybody else to seek that peace.
All right, Behind the Mask. I think there are a whole lot of listeners that say that's for me. The author, Amy Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E. And bottom line, when there's hope in our hearts, personally, there's hope for the rest of the world. Thanks for sharing your story, and thanks for this message of God's grace in the midst of such a difficult, difficult situation. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Brown.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
All right. I hope you found that as encouraging and helpful as I did listening. We'll be right back. I'm going to be speaking with author Billy Hallowell. We're going to change our focus to the end times.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
When I came to faith in 1971, November, December of 1971, I was told that Jesus was coming any moment, that the end was near, that all the signs of the times were there, and we should live with that sense of urgency. Jesus is coming any moment. And that was almost 45 years ago. I was 16. Our oldest granddaughter is now 15. So it's a long time since then. I live with a sense of urgency to this day. But what about the end times? And look, if everything is going to get worse, why stand? Right now, the federal government has declared war on North Carolina, basically. And North Carolina's fighting back is ongoing as I speak, this very moment. The next scene should unfold with Attorney General Loretta Lynch responding to North Carolina filing a lawsuit against the federal government in response to the federal government threatening to withhold $4.5 billion of school funding unless North Carolina allows men into women's locker rooms and bathrooms. Yes, that's what we're dealing with in North Carolina. But why stand if everything's getting worse, everything's going down? On the other hand, what if Jesus isn't coming for 500 years? What kind of world are we leaving to our kids, to our grandchildren? This is Michael Brown. Number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. And I'm speaking today with Billy Hallowell. Billy has a brand new book out. In fact, I participated in that book on the Armageddon Code, but it's unique. It is different than a normal end times book. It's written as a journalist. You'll see him at theblaze.com. You'll see his work on religion there. He's been working in journalism and media for more than a decade. You may have seen him on Fox News and other news outlets or read his writings there. Now he's written this book, The Armageddon Code, a journalist looking at the end times. Billy, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure thing. All right, listen, this first segment is brief, but in a couple of minutes, explain to me where your interest came from in this book and how your book is different than a typical end times book.
Yeah, I think I've always had an interest, like all of us, right? I think everybody, even if you're not a Christian, there's sort of this underlying intrigue in the end times. And this is why we kind of have a societal obsession with zombies and all these other zombie apocalypses and all of that. But I think the real practical nature for Christians, obviously, is that there is this promise of a second coming. And so all the details of the before, during, and after of that, of course, everybody disagrees on. But that second coming is what we're all looking to. So I've always had an interest in that. And I was working on a different book, and the publisher, Charisma, came and asked me about this subject. And we started talking about it, and you know, I felt like there are a lot of books out there that have been done that tell you from a perspective what to believe or propose a theory exactly what will happen, you know, the series of events in the end times. And you know, we can get into dangerous territory sometimes when we try to predict the dates. We're not supposed to do that. We're not supposed to predict individuals when it comes to things like the Antichrist. But the general sort of overview of events, whether or not there'll be a rapture, what the tribulation might look like, all of those elements are fascinating. And so we started talking about, what if we did a book that was just from a journalistic perspective, interviewing a series of individuals, 15 to 20 people, about what they believe, people who have been looking at this for a long time, people like you who have very solid ideas, and it was great to interview you for this project. We had Greg Laurie, Hank Hanegraaff, Joel Rosenberg, Tim LaHaye. We had a cross-section of people with very different views on a lot of these elements. And so that's the big difference. I think a lot of books that are out there, you know, you can get sort of a pre-tribulation rapture view, a premillennial view, or a postmillennial view maybe on things. But this book provides an overview of the entire debate. It looks at Israel and assesses, you know, the debate over Israel today. So that's the difference.
Awesome. All right, look, we're gonna unpack this, but this is fascinating. And by the way, I've glanced at different parts of the book, and it's written like a journalist would write. It gets your attention, and it takes you on a journey. Billy Hallowell, Armageddon Code.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
To all my friends listening on our great stations all over North Carolina, we talked about the battle with the federal government. We're encouraging you to contact Governor McCrory and thank him for taking a stand for sanity, for privacy, for safety, and for standing up against the bullies of the Obama administration right now. Contact him. Express your appreciation. If you're not sure how, just type in anywhere on your computer, your cell phone, contact Governor McCrory, and you'll see the contact info. We posted it on Facebook and Twitter as well. I am speaking with Billy Hallowell. You read his writings on religion on theblaze.com. He's got an exciting and unique new book called Armageddon Code, and he interviewed 20 different leaders, men as disparate in their views as Tim LaHaye, a staunch pre-trib rapture believer, to Hank Hanegraaff, who would be really on the opposite side of these issues in terms of the end times in Israel. And as a journalist asked, and I'm participant as well, a number of key questions. So, Billy, first, what were the basic questions that you asked? And if folks want to get in depth, they've got to read the book. But what questions did you put out to these different individuals?
You know, it really was kind of an interesting process. Because the book is divided topically, looking at things like the rapture, the Antichrist, you know, the tribulation, the millennium, Israel, and kind of going that way, kind of grouped the questions together like that. One of the first questions was, you know, where do you stand on the rapture? And that was a pretty open-ended question because people would say, oh, well, we believe in a pre-tribulation rapture, but then they would go into a deep explanation of why. And so it was kind of a fascinating process. But then those who said they didn't really believe in a rapture. And that was kind of an interesting perspective because you kind of had people saying, well, I don't believe in a rapture at all. Or you had people saying, well, there will be a rapture, but it'll be a post-tribulation rapture. It'll just be one and the same with the second coming. And that was really fascinating. So kind of open-ended questions like that. Will there be a future Antichrist? I think these are the basic questions. And that was sort of the intention. Start with the basic questions. What do most Christians want to know? I think a lot of us are confused about these issues. We don't understand them. There's been a lot in pop culture about these issues, Christian films that have been out there representing some of these issues, and I think it's created embarrassment for some, maybe confusion for others. And so the goal was to start with those basic questions and then get more complex. You know, once you get into the nitty-gritty of, okay, you believe in a rapture, now you can tell me when you think it's going to happen. Take me through why you believe that. And so the book kind of guides people through each of those things, but it's told through the interview subjects and what they believe. And so that was really what I wanted to do here. And it's sort of like a conversation, right, with all these different people. They're not having that conversation per se, but it's set up in that way.
All right. So you were able to unpack something that on the one hand can be pretty complex, but simplify it for the reader. So this is not a scholarly technical book where they're going to need a dictionary in one hand and a theology textbook in the other in order to read it. You've been able to unpack this in a way that your average reader who's just interested in what does the Bible say, what about the end times, they'll be able to work their way through this with no problem.
Absolutely, and that's the goal. And the other thing, and you can find this, we have two websites, endtimesanswers.com, which is the book website, and you can find it on Amazon, but we also have endtimesresearch.com, and the research that you can download there is pretty cool. I mean, we really went to pastors. We went to about 1,000 pastors through Lifeway Research and asked them a series of questions, because nobody, you know, we can have this discussion and debate, and we have the interviews with the 20 experts, but nobody has really gone to preachers in this country and asked them what they believe. And so we have research on their opinions about the Antichrist, about the millennium, and about a series of other issues. So that research is available, and that was sort of eye-opening and really intriguing to kind of learn what people are teaching in churches.
All right. Does it matter? Did you find that the varied different end times beliefs brought about any difference in how we would live today or how we would view Israel today or how we would view our role in society today? Is it just abstract, or does it actually affect how we live or what our attitudes are?
That's a great question, because a lot of people, you know, critics of the project would even say, why did you do this? There's a million end times books. And I think, again, this is a different book. But the other piece of it is, Yes, I mean, your opinions are shaped by a lot of these things. And when we talk about Israel, not that you're going to be anti-Israel if you don't see Israel 1948 as being a sort of a prophetic event, but there is that sort of discussion and debate of, okay, well, if you believe something is prophetic, you're probably going to protect it or hold it up and look at it differently than if you don't. And so there were a number of people who said, you know what, I don't believe that Israel was prophetic, but I believe God's hand is in it. And that was sort of an interesting perspective, that something is going on there. God is going to use Israel in some way, but that they don't necessarily see it as a fulfillment of prophecy in Ezekiel or anywhere else in the Old Testament. So yeah, absolutely. There are differences in how you're going to view Israel. And among some people, look at the political situation in the Middle East. It's going to impact how you view the battle in the Middle East between numerous parties, not just what's going on in Israel and in Palestine, but what's going on across the Middle East and Africa. So absolutely, and I think that is why this is so important. We want to understand, why do people believe what they believe? What do they believe, and how does that impact their broader worldview?
All right, so for example, if we stay focused on Israel for a moment, let's say all Christians would share together a heart for justice and want everyone treated fairly and rightly. But if you believe that God brought the Jewish people back to the land and Satan is trying to exterminate the Jewish people, you will see Israel in a different light than if you just believe it's the result of political happenstance or human effort or something like that. That alone would be a very important difference. What about the idea of we're out of here any moment, everything is getting worse, so an extreme dispensationalist viewpoint, I don't mean that every dispensationalist viewpoint is extreme, but the most extreme one would say everything's going downhill, we're out of here any minute, no reason to even try to change society, versus a post-millennial view that says the gospel will triumph through the whole world and basically the church, in a sense, takes over. Did you find that type of tension or difference rising in the interviews?
Yeah, that was a really fascinating dynamic, because both polar ends of that, I think there are critics of and supporters for. But the problem, I think, with the first view is that, you know, if you remove yourself totally from the world, we talk about how bad the world is. I always wonder, okay, well, things are absolutely awful in the world, but what would it be like without Christians? If we didn't have Christianity here, we didn't have believers operating and working throughout the world to make things better, if we didn't have that message of hope, how much worse would it be? Much worse than it is now, right? So to not do anything, if you hold the view, oh, well, we're just going to be raptured out of here eventually anyway, so let's just sit back, let's not vote, let's not do anything. There are a lot of problems with that viewpoint, I think, and that is not what we're called to do, I don't believe. And then with the post-millennial, it's sort of fascinating, because this notion of things getting better and better, a lot of people would say, no, 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 there's no way that that is possible. Look at the world, it's gotten worse. But I think, you know, the response that Douglas Wilson gave me to that was, hey, you know, when you look at that paradigm, if you look at 500-year increments, if you look at broader increments, things might actually be looking up more than you'd realize. And people could have that discussion and that debate. I do think for a lot of Christians, and the biggest chunk of Christians that we found, or at least pastors that we found in the research, definitely looked at a scenario where things would be getting a little more negative as time went on and didn't really have that post-millennial viewpoint.
Got it. So you've got, along with the 20 experts you interviewed, you also bring in the research based on 1,000 pastors that you interviewed?
Yes, yeah, there were 1,000 pastors, and that research was really fascinating, because the first question we asked them was their views on the rapture. And interestingly, the largest percentage, and this surprised some people, it was the pre-tribulation belief. That was about 36% of pastors. The second biggest group, though, was 25%, and those were pastors who said they didn't believe the rapture was meant to be taken literally. So you've got 36% versus 25%, and then the post-tribulation rapture was 18% of pastors. And then there were, you know, some other groups in there as well, but those were the three big ones.
And what about premillennial versus amillennial versus postmillennial? Do you remember those stats?
Yes. So for premillennialism, that was by far the broadest group, the biggest group. It was 48% were premillennium. Post was only 11%. So that was pretty small. Amillennium was 31%. So those were the breakdowns.
Got it. Very, very interesting. And of course, Lifeway pastors, they've got a lot of people, but then that reflects a certain segment of the body as opposed to the whole. But these are, I don't know that this has been done before on this level. So that's terrific, just to get that feedback. You know what's interesting, though, also, Billy, is that a lot of it tends to be where we are in history. In other words, postmillennialism is a lot weaker in the immediate aftermath of World War II than it might be at a more optimistic time in world history. Or before you have Israel back on the map in the Middle East, premillennial beliefs were probably lower because it just seemed too far-fetched that it was going to happen. All right, friends, I've got a few more minutes with Billy Hallowell. His new book, and I'm not just saying this because he's on the air, this is fascinating stuff. And it's so neat to read the different arguments side by side without a technical, big, heavy book. It's called Armageddon Code. So I'm one of the 20 experts interviewed in it. And then he's got surveys from 1,000 pastors. So it's definitely a unique and different book. You can get it at your bookstore or go online, Amazon.com or other online bookstores to order. Armageddon Code, Billy Hallowell, spelled H-A-L-L-O-W-E-L-L.
Join Dr. Michael Brown along with Messianic Jewish pastor Scott Volk for a unique behind-the-scenes tour of Israel, February 25th through March 6, 2017. Space is limited, so we're accepting applications on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information on the trip and to secure your spot, please visit our website at AskDrBrown.org and click on the Israel Tour banner or call our office at 704-782-3760.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Billy Hallowell about his brand new book, Armageddon Code. It's a journalist looking at the end times, but through the lens of 20 experts. I was one of them privileged to be interviewed in the book. And through the lens of 1,000 pastors. And then Billy weaves this all together as kind of an ongoing conversation and narrative. Billy, how did this affect you writing this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really, because I tried to put everything to the side, what I've grown up with and what I've traditionally believed and what I believe now. And so it was interesting and eye-opening to sort of hear some of the perspectives that, I didn't really know existed before, to be honest, or I knew they kind of existed but didn't know a whole lot about them. I think the full preterists, they were the most surprising. The belief that all this basically came to an end, all the end times stuff pretty much happened in 70 AD, and there is nothing left to be fulfilled. I didn't resonate with that belief at all, but I found it interesting. And I think for me, the big takeaway was that we can look forward to the second coming of Christ, and we can have these debates about all these different elements. It's important that we understand what other Christians believe, I think, and it's important that we have our beliefs. And I think this book sort of helps you figure out where you stand and helps you find the backing for where you stand. But it also helps you understand those other perspectives that I think are really important. We have to find unity where we can find unity, and that was sort of my takeaway on this.
Yeah, and it is interesting that I've worked with folks with a wide variety of end time views over the years. And many times I've worked with folks for decades in different nations, and I don't know that we've ever discussed it because we focused on loving the Lord and touching the lost and the hurting and making disciples and planting churches and things like that. And a lot of the issues don't come up. But when they do come up, boy, they can be divisive. And I've had full preterists tell me that there's no future resurrection to look to, that we're already in the new heavens and the new earth. So
that's a scary thought, actually.
Yeah.
That was my takeaway. I hope this isn't the new heaven and the new earth, because my gosh, that would be troubling to me. But they have very solid views on it, and they can explain to you why they think that. But that's a very, very small percentage of people, too, which was really interesting. I think it was only 1% of people in the survey who, out of the 1,000 that we surveyed.
Which I'm glad to hear it was that low. Billy, did this give you more, even though you went through all the different views, so you hear all the good arguments, which is important. Let's not live in a bubble. Let's understand the different views that the church has held to over the centuries and to this day. But did the return of Jesus, the end times, did these things become more real to you the more you looked at them?
Absolutely, they did. And I think what really became more real to me, and I know that even saying this, because I tried not to take too many stands in the book on these issues, Israel became much more real to me. I understood a lot more. I looked a lot at Ezekiel 36-39, and that is the piece of the book that just stands out to me the most, because you know, this notion of Israel coming back together, being reformed, and then 1948 happening, I find it personally so strange. If I were an atheist, I would say to myself, this is so bizarre. It would almost force me to believe, right? That would be, I feel like Israel is like one of those things that it just, it's so compelling in light of what is written that it would compel me to believe. Again, some experts say no way, that those things in Ezekiel have already come to fruition. 1948 wasn't one of them. I tend to think a little bit differently on that.
Yeah, and just my two cents in that, of course, being with you on it totally. A little syllogism. We know when God opens the door, no one can close it. When he closes the door, no one can open it. When he blesses, no one can curse. When he curses, no one can bless. When he scatters, no one can regather. When he regathers, no one can scatter. So if he, in fact, scattered Israel in his wrath, then who regathered them? It's a little question. I've put it out for theologians. I put it out on the air. I put it out on social media. No one's given me a coherent answer yet. Because if people did it, then people can undo what God does. So I'm with you on that. Hey, Billy, really looking forward to my own copy. I know it's in the mail, and a copy for our school library. But friends, get a copy of Armageddon Code. You won't be disappointed. The author, Billy Hallowell. Great talking to you, man.
Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. All right, friends, we are out of, well, no, we're not totally out of time. We're not totally out of time. I've got one more thing I want to do. Oh, last year, I did a CD on the subject of God's true grace. Last year or two, just bathing the listeners in what God's Word says about grace. I want to play a sample of that for you and then tell you how you can get that with my new book, Grace Controversy. Let's listen.
Hebrews 12:14, strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God. What? Obtain? No, not earn. Not earn. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled, that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. We can forfeit God's grace. See, here's what you have to understand. You never, ever have to worry about God's keeping power. You never, ever have to worry about the sufficiency of his grace. You never, ever have to worry about it running out, because it never will. You never, ever have to worry about God doing what he said he would do. He's the author and the finisher of our faith. You have to make a determination. I am going to commit spiritual suicide. I am going to commit spiritual suicide. I am going to go the way of Esau. In English, I am going to spurn the grace of God. The good news is God's promised to keep us. The good news is you can put your trust in the one who finished the work to bring it to completion. God's grace not only starts the work, the work continues. He carries it out. He wills and does his good pleasure in us, which is why we work out our own salvation in fear and trembling before him. And then forever and ever, we'll experience more and more of the grace, the goodness, the amazing kindness, the power, the transforming love of God forever and ever and ever.
All right, friends, that's an excerpt from my CD, God's True Grace. We've got three terrific grace resources. In fact, when you order this week, Hyper Grace and the God's True Grace CD, you get free my brand new book, The Grace Controversy. I've been blessed to get reviews on the book, or people posting on Facebook, just a couple reviews up so far, but people have contacted me on Facebook and said, I'm a grace preacher, and your book changed my view on something. I didn't see this before. Now I see a way to even receive more grace. I'm a grace preacher. I thought we had a lot of differences. Wow, reading your book, I see we don't. And others saying, this book, in simple, clear terms, not heavy theology, will open up your heart and mind to the truths about grace and spare you from the error of hypergrace. So to get my book, The Grace Controversy, free, when you order Hypergrace and the God's True Grace CD, go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. or call 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, remember, God is moving. God is working. No matter what you see with your eyes, God is moving behind the scenes.